From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. This is Ken Tucker sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Buddy and Julie Miller. They're husband and wife musicians who put out solo albums. They've also written hits for country music acts like the Dixie Chicks, Garth Brooks, and Leanne Womack. We invited them to bring along a couple of guitars, sing a few songs, and talk about how you can use a plastic garbage pail as a percussion instrument. Also, art critic Dave Hickey, who makes the high culture case for Saturday Evening Post illustrator Norman Rockwell. Rockwell's paintings of small-town America have been assembled in an exhibition that's now touring the country. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton says he's optimistic that the budget standoff with Congress will be resolved soon, and he's particularly pleased with a new compromise on a plan to hire new teachers. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
White House and congressional budget negotiators have surmounted a big hurdle. They have agreed to give the president almost all of the $1.4 billion he had insisted on to hire new teachers to reduce class size. And as he pointed out, the Republicans got one of their demands as well.
The program gives school districts the flexibility to use 25% of the funds from this program to train and test new teachers. It also increases flexibility with the involvement of the Secretary of Education to get extra funds for school districts that have a high percentage of their teachers that are not certified to teach the subjects they have been hired to teach, so that they can become fully qualified in those subjects.
Lawmakers and the White House are getting close to agreements on other issues, including a compromise on international debt relief and a plan to fund overdue payments to the United Nations. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The search for the cockpit voice recorder from Egypt Air Flight 990 was suspended early this morning because of rough seas. Officials are predicting better weather tomorrow and Saturday that will allow two remote-controlled underwater robots to resume the search. Experts hope the cockpit voice recorder will help them determine what happened during the final moments of the flight before it crashed into the sea, killing all 217 people aboard. The plane's flight data recorder showed that the flight was normal until the plane's autopilot mysteriously disconnected. The plane then made what appeared to be a controlled descent before plunging into the sea. The United States has expressed concern about Israel's plan to sell a sophisticated airborne radar system to China. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
American officials are concerned that Israel might have given U.S. military technology to China as part of the airborne radar sale. Washington transfers such technology to its allies on the condition that they not pass it along to third parties. President Clinton.
Whenever any of our friends sell sophisticated equipment that might be American in origin that is inconsistent with the terms under which the transfer was made, then we raise that.
In this case, the president said, the facts are in dispute. When the facts are clear, he said, we'll decide what's appropriate to do. A spokesman for the Israeli embassy strongly denied that protected U.S. technology was part of the airborne radar sale to China. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 10,595. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading of 882 million shares. This is NPR. Police in Colombia say a car bomb killed at least 8 people and injured about 45 today in Bogota. Mayor Enrique Peñalosa told the Associated Press that the blast may have been a threat intended to stop the government's plan to resume extraditing suspected drug traffickers to the United States. Earlier this week, Colombia's highest court approved the extradition of 2 alleged drug traffickers to the U.S., a decision that still must be ratified by the president. U.S. prosecutors have requested the extradition of 42 drug suspects now being held in Colombian jails. Lady Bird Johnson was rushed to the hospital after fainting at home in Austin, Texas today. The former First Lady is now said to be doing well and is in no danger. More from Eric Roy with Texas Public Radio.
Doctors decided to keep Lady Bird Johnson in the hospital overnight for observation. Seton Medical Center spokeswoman Stephanie Elsie says Mrs. Johnson was awake and alert when she arrived at the hospital and is listed in fair condition.
She apparently fainted at home this morning and was brought to Seton Medical Center here in Austin by ambulance.
Elsie says Mrs. Johnson was treated for heat exhaustion in September. She's reportedly had fainting spells in the past and recently had cataract surgery in Houston. The widow of former President Lyndon Johnson, Lady Bird Johnson, is the oldest living First Lady and will celebrate her 87th birthday December 22nd. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy.
The Clinton administration has reached an agreement with Congress that would provide $11 billion in Medicare payment increases for health care providers. Hospital outpatient departments that get the extra money would have to accept a new limit on the out-of-pocket costs that recipients pay for outpatient tests or surgery. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. Buddy and Julie Miller are married musicians, but they maintain separate careers. Buddy, whose new CD is called Cruel Moon, is a much-in-demand guitar player and songwriter who's played with Emmylou Harris, Linda Ronstadt, and Lucinda Williams. Julie, whose latest release is Broken Things, has toured with Steve Earle. The Millers' songs have been recorded by country artists like Garth Brooks, the Dixie Chicks, and Brooks and Dunn. We invited them to the WPLN studios in Nashville to sing a few songs and discuss writing tunes for big stars and for each other. Before we talk to them, here's a bit of the opening track from Buddy's Cruel Moon.
When I gave you my heart, it was not what you wanted. Now the walls say your name, and the pictures are haunted. Does my ring burn your finger? Did my love weigh you down? Was a promise too much to keep around?
Buddy and Julie met in the late 70s when Buddy auditioned for a band that Julie was in. I began by asking them what they initially thought of each other.
Well, I thought she was great and cute.
You did. Thank you. Well, actually, my first impression was this was the first band I'd really been in, and I didn't really know if someone was a good guitar player or not. So when they asked me if I thought he should be in the band, I really had no idea. So just to be on the safe side, I said no. But of course, they realized then that I really had no judgment whatsoever. They hired him anyway, and we soon became real pals. We were real friends for years. We ate breakfast tacos together for years before we had a romantic inclination.
When did the romantic inclination kick in?
Oh, around 1979 or so.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had a different boyfriend who kind of hurt my feelings one day. We were all three in the same band, and we were at a sound check, and I did something extremely stupid, which I really won't say what I did, but...
Why not?
Because it's the stupidest thing you've ever heard.
It's not that stupid.
Oh, think about it. Okay, since you have editing power, you want me to tell you?
Yes, please.
Okay, well, let's just preface it to say that I was an extremely insecure person. That's just an understatement, too. But I had the blues, and I wanted to sing. I had decided I wanted to sing Tobacco Road. So at soundcheck one day, I decided to get the band to work it up. But for some reason, I was totally psyched out, and I for some reason, if you're not familiar with the song, it's just kind of your typical blues. Well, I was born in a dump, but for some reason, this is all I could do. Okay, here we go. One, I would only sing when the music was playing.
One, two, three.
Well, I was born. And so my boyfriend looked at me like, you know, you can't be this stupid. And for some reason, I got it in my head. I could not sing in the spaces. Well, so anyway, I left in tears because I know I thought, I'm crazy. I was a... Buddy Miller came up to me about a few minutes later with an ice cream cone.
How nice.
That
how
was my smooth...
How romantic.
That was my smooth move, yeah.
Very smooth.
He hands me this ice cream cone. This was the first revelation of this that I had. I just was like kind of wiping tears away and eating this ice cream cone and kind of looking over at him and looking at the ice cream cone and looking back at him and suddenly realizing, I think I like this guy with the ice cream cone. And that's how it all began.
Well, since we're talking about music and we're talking about tears, I think this is a good time for you to play a song for us. It's tears in a very different context. I wonder if you could do your song, All My Tears.
Sure.
I'll tune up for it. It won't take me long, I promise. And I do like that Tobacco Road.
Oh, gosh.
It was something. It went... The whole band would stop, and there'd be nothing there for the longest time. Everybody just looking at her.
You know, for the sake of others' humor and entertainment, I will humble myself down into the dirt.
We played with Cry, Cry, Cry the other night, and when we came on stage, they were planning on doing Tobacco Road for, in your honor.
Don't matter where I lay. All my tears.
thank you. That's Buddy and Julie Miller. Buddy's new CD is called Cruel Moon. Julie's latest is Broken Things. If I could go back to this kind of chronology of your career, around 1980, Buddy, you were on the verge of a record deal and you moved from Texas to New Jersey?
Well, right outside of New York City. We wanted to move to New York City, but we thought it's too dangerous there. So we were in Union City where we got robbed, I don't know, a couple of times, a couple of nights in a row. We were right in between the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel.
Uh-huh.
It was great.
Truly great or kind of scary great?
A little bit of both. It was great.
Uh-huh. Julie, I've read that this was kind of a difficult time for you. You were kind of depressed at this point. What were you going through around this time?
Yeah, I was just going through a time of basically wondering what everything is, who I was, what's the point? I'm sort of tend to be fall into melancholia mm-hmm. rather easily, and
I read that you said once, all my life, even when I was like 12 years old, I was depressed.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when I was 8 or 9 years old saying, "I wish I was dead."
Uh-huh.
So, I felt that I really needed to find a reason to live,
mm-hmm.
or it was just too much trouble, and it just didn't seem worth the pain. And I, being from the South, had grown up with Christianity that, for me, seemed more like kind of like a little club.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much decided that I wanted to find the truth, and that was definitely not the truth. And so I was pretty much open to anything but Christianity. And I watched some friends of mine die, and I would just sit and I would think, I'm here right now, and I'm going to be, but I'm not going to be here at some point, And somewhere along the way, got a hold of a book called Tortured for His Faith about this, it was written by this man who was tortured for being a Christian behind the Iron Curtain for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he just loved the people that tortured him and everything. And it was like he was a real Christian. And somehow reading that man's story, that was like, wow, he's like a real Christian, like the people in the Bible were. And then at the same time, Bob Dylan had come out with his second gospel record.
Mm-hmm.
And the combination of reading that book and hearing those songs just brought to me hearing from God, and a lot of things happened. A buddy came in with the new Emmylou Harris record. He put it on, and she was singing Green Pastures, and there was a line in there, "Those who have strayed were sought by the Master. He who once gave his life for the sheep, out on the mountain still he is searching, bringing them in forever to keep." And Buddy just was enjoying how beautiful it sounded with Ricky Skaggs and Dolly Parton singing along with Emmylou. Well, I just started crying and weeping, and I could just feel the compassion of God for me. And
And Buddy, what was your reaction to all this at the time?
Well, I was just watching it for a while. I mean, I thought you were listening to that Bob Dylan record because you liked the cowbell.
Yeah, I was at first.
Yeah.
Clydie King's background vocals, really.
We were both listening for Clydie King. Uh-huh. And I kind of watched. Julie was the wildest person I knew. I mean, she was just wild. So I'd watch. And when she left, there was just such a big change that I couldn't help but take notice and see what was going on.
Buddy and Julie Miller. They write songs for themselves and some major country stars. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Seems like I've been here before. Just outside some closing door.
My guests are Julie and Buddy Miller. Buddy has a new CD out called Cruel Moon. I know, Julie, that you don't consider yourself as much of a country performer as Buddy might, but do you like Hank Williams' Luke the Drifter songs? There's so much about faith and despair and redemption.
Oh, totally. Yeah. His songs are like the foundation of songwriting. I don't see any songwriter could go on without starting there, you know?
Yeah. Seems like a lot of the songs you both write are about relationships that are on the verge of breaking up or are at least being, you know, very severely tested. There aren't too many, gee, ain't we a happy couple songs.
I know.
Well, I think you have to blame that, like, on the Lubin Brothers and Hank Williams and people like that. It's like, I think that we got founded in sad songs before we started writing, and then we got all happy, but it was too late for the songs. They still have to be sad.
Uh-huh. There was a review I liked that said the seemingly happy couple.
And you know, sometimes I'll write some happy lyrics and the songs just are terrible. I don't know what it is. I feel really bad.
So you try to write happy songs, they just come out.
Exactly.
Well, I'd like you to perform one of those sadder songs, Broken Things.
Okay.
Thanks.
You can have my been used and broken, it only comes in blue. It's been down a long road, and it got dirty on the way. If I give it to you, these tears,
That's Julie and Buddy Miller with the title song from Julie's CD, Broken Things. We'll hear more from the Millers in the second half of the show. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air. Let's hear the Dixie Chicks covering Buddy's song, Hole in My Head, from their new album, Fly.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By Time Magazine, featuring its Person of the Century poll to determine who most influenced the course of events over the past 100 years. Time.com. By Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And by WGBH Boston, producer of Mystery, airing the Mrs. Bradley Mysteries with host Diana Rigg in the title role, tonight on PBS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with art critic Dave Hickey, who's written a defense of one of America's most beloved but critically underrated artists, Norman Rockwell. And more country rock music from Buddy and Julie Miller, with conversations about the strains and comfort of touring together as a married couple and about writing songs for other artists. This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker. We're continuing our talk with Buddy and Julie Miller, musicians whose songs have been covered by many country stars. I know, Buddy and Julie Miller, that you've been out touring together. I myself recently caught one of your shows in which Julie provided percussion by hitting a hotel plastic garbage pail with a stick. Does it cause any strain on the marriage to be, together all day and then you go out at night and you perform together?
No, I don't think there's a strain. Sometimes I'm concerned that something might fly out of her little trash can and hit someone in the audience, but we're doing okay.
Well, that's good.
Well, we should mention there's a few other objects in the, there's some tambourines and such things.
Yes, there are real instruments. It's not a completely improvised performance. Well, you two seem to outward appearances to have one of the more successful close marriages in the music world. Is it you know, singing all day around the Miller household?
Yeah, we're just singing all day long.
That's what I figured, yeah. Well, are there songs that either of you have written where the person who wrote it says, oh, that's no good, and wants to scrap it, but the other person says, no, wait, that's good, you've got to develop that?
Well, that happens all the time. Well, sort of all the time. It sort of happened, actually, with one of Julie's songs that I just found that would have probably gotten thrown out, that... I was looking for songs for a record of mine, not the new one, but the one before, and just going through some old cassettes and found this little snippet of her singing this Don't Tell Me to Stop Loving You, the just beautiful country song that I don't think that you even remembered you sang, probably. And no. Just heard it and loved it, and we finished it.
And worked it up into a finished song.
Yeah.
Yeah. And does it work the other way around, too? Can you be brutally honest with each other and hear each other's music and say, honey, that song ain't cutting it, so I'm sorry?
I think so. I think that happens every day around the house.
It does.
But he's way more diplomatic.
Really?
If she doesn't like something I'm playing, mostly on her record.
Oh, dear.
And so are those bad songs, or are those the ones you offer the Dixie Chicks?
No, that song, and you know that song Don't Tell Me, that ended up, Leanne Womack cut it and did a beautiful version of it.
Is that right?
That would have just ended up in a trash can. We never would have known about it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that song the Dixie Chicks did, I knew that was a hit from the very beginning.
Did you?
We're
talking about
yeah.
the song Hole in My Head that appears on the new Dixie Chicks.
That was one of Buddy's first songs and first lyrical attempts as well, and I was so blown away. You make me feel so bad. I wish I was dead. You don't get any better than that.
Can you play? Can you play a few bars of that?
Sure, sure.
I need a girl like you, like a hole in my head. Let's just say we will and then don't stare.
It's a little bit of that one.
Why do you think other artists are able to cover your songs and get them played on the radio, but your own versions of the same songs can't crack country or pop or rock radio?
They can't.
It's news to you, huh? Gee, I didn't mean it to sound so. It sounded so blunt after that dead silence.
No. Actually, what I was thinking was, well, we're just surprised that anyone's getting anywhere. It never entered our mind when we wrote them and recorded them that somebody else would take them anywhere. So that's kind of...
But you've had an awfully good track record. I mean, you know, there are albums where the majority of the songs on one or the other of your CDs have been covered by other artists.
That's the strangest thing. And it's not like we make our records with that in mind at all. We just kind of... Gosh, I hope we finish the songs in time to get the record done. It's more along those lines. We're working under such pressure at home.
That's right. You. But Buddy, I take forever, I have to say. But Buddy's so incredible. He's a riot. He does everything so fast. He, like, writes his songs driving to the studio. He literally writes them in the car. He'll be, oh, let's see, I need a song. Yeah, so.
What songs have you written? Have you written in the car that fast?
Well, that Hole in My Head sure got started that way. Most of it got done. And Jim Lauderdale wrote that with me, but that got started in a car.
Huh. What's been the extent of your contact with the major labels? Do they ever come around interested, but at some point it breaks down because you're not going to make the kind of album they want you to make? It seems like to me that Nashville has a certain kind of album they want country acts to make. and it's probably not the kind of record you want to make. Is that true?
Well, I don't know, because they've never really asked. and you know, we're actually, at least I'm really happy where we're at with the, we're both on the same label. It's a little label in the Bay Area called Hightone, and they like what we do, and they give us complete freedom to do what we like to do. And
yeah, it's really great. It's to try to be moldable for someone is just, I don't think either one of us could ever. It'd be kind of like trying to mold a little moth into a butterfly. It just, you know, you got to take the moth or leave it. It's not going to.
Right.
You'd start trying to mold it, it's just going to crumble. And so, yeah, it's just great to be able to creatively not have outside voices in your head when you're doing stuff.
Yeah.
They say, we'd like a record from you, and if you can turn it in around this time, and that's the extent of their involvement in the creative process, and we record in our house. We just set up in the living room, dining room areas, and make them there, and they're happy with that.
Is the finished product that we hear is stuff that's recorded in your house?
Oh yeah, I don't know if I'd call it a finished product.
Well, the stuff that gets released is genuinely homemade.
Yeah,
totally.
Why have you never recorded a Julie and Buddy Miller album, an official kind of duet album?
She wouldn't let me. But I think we're going to do that next year.
That's not true.
And why is that? Why would
she
not
planning.
Let
That's not true. Well, he, you know, his vision for me is a little more strictly country than I feel I would like to be. But actually, I've gotten a little bit of this other music out of my system, and I think we're going to do this duet record, and I've let Buddy he's going to make it as country as he wants to. It's just going to be Last Stop to Hicksville.
And Buddy, do you think you'll ever have a rock and roll album in you to put out?
Well, the more I'm working with Julie, the more that crazy rock stuff gets on my records, I think, or her influence. Yeah, I don't think so.
I'm wondering if you could sing us another song, perhaps Somewhere Trouble Don't Go?
Sure, we'd love to. It's this one Julie played drums on the record along with the drummer, Brian Owings. Julie was set up on the floor she didn't have the trash can at that point in time, but she had a lot of tambourines. I think she might have broken two or three during the recording of that song. I looked in the other room, and the drummer was looking in there, and you just see him flying in the air. So she's going to try to recreate that magic on her hotel trash can.
Yes.
We'll think about that as we listen.
Yeah.
Trouble don't know. Hey, hey, hey. drive my car, but she wants to go too far. But she wants to go too far. First comes love, it's so fine. Here comes heartache right behind. Here comes heartache right behind. My baby used to be so sweet. Now she won't come down my street. Now she won't come down my street. Hey, hey, all my plans got derailed. She locked up my heart in jail. She locked up my heart in jail. Take me somewhere trouble don't go.
Buddy and Julie Miller. Thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate you talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you too.
Buddy Miller's new CD is Cruel Moon. Julie's is Broken Things. Coming up, a reassessment of Norman Rockwell. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Dave Hickey, is one of those rare art critics whose essays and reviews can be understood and enjoyed by readers who don't have a degree in art history or deconstructionism. His most recent book is entitled Air Guitar, Essays on Art and Democracy, which also offers assessments of Hank Williams, Donald Duck, and Perry Mason. Hickey teaches art criticism at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and he recently wrote an eloquent defense for the Saturday Evening Post illustrator Norman Rockwell as an archetypal American painter. The essay appears in the catalog for an exhibition that's touring the country called Norman Rockwell, Pictures for the American People, which can currently be seen at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, Georgia. I asked Hickey to remind us of who Rockwell was.
Well, Norman Rockwell was a commercial illustrator who worked beginning for most American magazines, but principally for the Saturday Evening Post, for most of this century, beginning the early part of this century up until the early 70s. Actually, one of the peculiar things about Rockwell is that people do know who he is. I ask my students all the time if they know who he is, and somehow they found out. I'm not exactly sure why or how.
In your essay, you quote John Updike as saying that Rockwell always gave a little more than the occasion strictly demands. How would you characterize Rockwell's most typical art beyond that?
Well, I was spinning Updike, of course. Updike is just being prissy and puritanical. I'm just saying he actually is a very he's a very generous artist and a very devoted artist to making well-designed images. Mm-hmm. And he always does more than's required just to get printed in a commercial in a commercial publication.
In your essay, you discuss a particular painting, which is entitled After the Prom. Could you describe right. what's going on in that picture and why you like it?
Well, I can describe what's going on in the picture, which is that you have a couple of teenagers after the prom sitting at a soda fountain. There's a working guy sitting to their left, and behind the counter is a soda jerk who appears to be the brother of the young man in the image. The young lady is lifting her corsage, her gardenia corsage, to be sniffed by the soda jerk behind the counter, and the young man is looking on happily, as is the working guy, who is also obviously a veteran.
The time period is about what, in the 50s, you would say?
I'd say 54, I think.
Yeah.
Thereabouts. And what I like about the picture is almost impossible to explain on radio. It is an extremely elegantly designed picture. just in the traditional European sense. As far as its narrative qualities, it's typical of a great many of Rockwell's pictures in that they don't really teach us what to do. It sort of purports to show us how people should react to what people do. a lot of Rockwell's paintings are simply about the responses of citizens to the behavior of other citizens. And that is the general tenor of a great many of his paintings simply has to do with the nature of the response. And it is, to a certain extent, always a benign and idealized and tolerant response.
Why did you title the essay with an allusion to the Who, the kids are all right?
Well, because I firmly believe this, that Rockwell was one of the few creatures in American popular culture in the 50s who actually privileged kids and their disobedient and willful disagreeableness and tendency to break rules. And I think that he really sort of, I don't know if we'd have had a lot of the 60s without the sort of benign permission of Rockwell's images. As I say, I always like to imagine these kids in Rockwell's paintings growing up, since I grew up pretty much contemporaneously with them, you know. I imagine those kids at the soda fountain sitting around in some commune in New Mexico trying to recapture that moment. And there's a wonderful painting of a girl with a black eye sitting outside the principal's office having gotten in a fight and obviously won. And it's not hard to imagine her a few years later burning her bra. Uh-huh.
Yes, and, I saw that picture, and she looks absolutely delighted. She has this big shiner, and she's sitting there with this huge grin on her face, like she's really pleased that she punched somebody out, probably.
Exactly. And that sort of attitude is kind of pervasive in Rockwell. I mean, that sort of tolerance for sort of the disobedience of youth. And I know when I was a kid, I always found it extremely empowering, as we say these days.
In the title essay of Air Guitar, you write something that I think is true, but that few critics are willing to admit, namely that people, and I'm going to quote you here, despise critics because people despise weakness, and criticism is the weakest thing you can do in writing. It's the written equivalent of air guitar, flurries of silent, sympathetic gestures with nothing at their heart but the memory of the music. It neither saves the things we love nor ruins the things we hate. So I guess my question is, why then be a critic?
Well, for the same reason that you do anything in culture, you want your views to prevail. You want to win. That is, you have a view of culture that is with which you are comfortable. You imagine a world in which you would be happy. And you're always, I think, arguing in favor of a world that is more like that. And you want to win. I mean, that is, if I see an artist whose work I believe in, I want everyone to believe in it. This is the occasion to write with as much strength and persuasiveness as you can, always presuming that, you know, the influence of art criticism is roughly that of secondhand smoke. So, you know, it's very difficult to document.
You've done things
besides... And probably just as toxic.
Are you? I had read that you had studied literature and linguistics. Are you also trained in art history or in art in any way?
No, I don't make visual art. Yes, my background is in literature and linguistics.
And so, how did you come to want to teach about art as opposed to pursuing those subjects?
Well, it's my view of writers that there's no situation that needs more than two, I was not very comfortable in what you would call academic literary culture, and most literary culture in America is academic in one way or another. All of my friends were artists. I tend to be interested in the incarnate aspects of writing, in the phonotext and what it sounds like, about how it feels, and the sort of physical cadences. I'm interested in the language as a physical thing and not as a disembodied sign system. Mm-hmm. And that aligns there. And as a consequence, there was a point in my life when I figured out that, from my point of view, Edward Richey and Jasper Johns knew more about the language in the way that I wanted to know than Norman Mailer did. In other words, I was just a lot more comfortable in art culture.
My guest is art critic Dave Hickey. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Dave Hickey is my guest. His most recent book is Air Guitar, Essays on Art and Democracy. You were also a rock critic for a time, writing in what I guess we can now start considering almost the golden age of rock criticism, when people like Lester Bangs and Richard Meltzer and people like yourself could write long, very strongly opinionated pieces about music that was, you know, at the time, widely considered ephemeral when it wasn't considered actively harmful to the culture, I think. What's your take on rock criticism?
Well, its institutionalization and sort of its infection with the rhetoric of Frankfurt School cultural studies idioms has not really perked it up very much, in my view. I regarded rock criticism, and really everything I write as I do now, is basically a form of Victorian reportage. In other words, what I'm doing is not any different from what Robert Louis Stevenson did, or De Quincey did, or Ruskin did. I'm just talking about the stuff that's happening in front of my eyes. I loved rock criticism. That is, the upside of it was that it didn't make any difference. You can actually, as a critic, harm an artist's career. We used to say, you know, if you knock an art show, you can hurt somebody's life. If you knock a rock record, it just makes this funny vinyl noise. And so that was the nice thing about it. I mean, you were absolutely, it was a free discourse. You weren't so much criticizing rock as improvising on the occasion of a record. And that was an enormous permission. It was a great deal of fun. I can remember, you know, standing out in the street in front of CBGB's with old Lester and Duncan and a bunch of us, watching the people coming out with their ears bleeding. And
we're talking about the Lower East Side Club in New York that was kind of the fount of New York punk rock.
Right, exactly. And actually, only the dictators, Handsome Dick Manitoba, could actually make people's ears bleed, in my experience. But I think this was Dick being the precursor of Jesse Ventura, I would suppose, the inventor of wrestling rock. But no, that was I really love the idea of making it up as you go along. I mean, this all of the things that went on at CBGB's were weird stuff that people made up out in Brooklyn, you know, in Long Island,
acts like the Ramones and Talking Heads and Television and Patti Smith and people like
that. Exactly. Milk and Cookies and Dead Boys, my favorites. And it's always amazing to see what people will do left to their own devices. And it's always my effort as a critic, with regard to the sort of governance of culture, to try as much as possible to see that people are left to their own devices. I'm a Darwinian in culture in terms of cultural production. And the difficulty there is that the artistic discourse is the last refuge of creationism in Western culture. It's totally obsessed with creationism of one sort or another, with the artist and what the artist wants and what the artist does. I'm really interested in the consequences of the works of art themselves.
How did you come to live in Las Vegas? This seems like an odd spot in America to find an art critic, or am I being naive about the art scene in Las Vegas?
Well, a little naive. I mean, this is a visible place. This is a visual place. People will tell you that Las Vegas is the future. It may be, but from my point of view, Las Vegas is the 70s with valet parking. You know, it's a big, permissive, libertarian, gambling, smoking, drinking, stay up late, scungilly at 3 in the morning town. That's the kind of environment in which I'm very comfortable.
Well, Dave Hickey, thank you very much for talking with me.
It is my pleasure.
Dave Hickey's most recent book is Air Guitar, Essays on Art and Democracy. He has an essay about Norman Rockwell in a catalog that accompanies a nationwide tour of Rockwell's art. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Helen Wong. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Ken Tucker.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Pain Free at Your PC by Pete Egoscue, a program of stretches and exercises designed to relieve repetitive stress syndrome. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And from Little Brown & Company, publishers of Walkin' the Dog by Walter Mosley, now in hardcover wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, mystery writer and child psychologist Jonathan Kellerman. His novel Billy Strayed is now in paperback and on the bestseller list. Also, writer William Trevor. His novel Felicia's Journey is the basis of a new Adam Egoyan film. Join us for the next Fresh Air.